The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 363, Confessions of a Mormon Psychic Spy, What My 7 Years as a Government Remote Viewer Taught Me About the Gospel, by Paul H. Smith, with comments by Cindy Lefevre. The chair is Sherry Pendleton. This session is 60 minutes long and recorded on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Okay, let's get started. I'd like to welcome you all out. Sorry, it's such a small room, but I think we're all managed. Should be an interesting session right now. I want to introduce to you Paul Hamilton Smith. You've probably all heard a little bit about him, but I'll just do a brief introduction. He served in the government remote viewing program at Fort Meade, Maryland for 7 years, and he did over 1,000 hours of training and operational remote viewing sessions during that time. He has a BA from Brigham Young University in Middle East Affairs, Art, and English, an MS from the Defense Intelligence College with Middle East concentration, and is currently enrolled in a PhD program in philosophy, specializing in consciousness and philosophy of mind. And currently he works as a freelance remote viewer and RV consultant and is president and chief instructor of Remote Viewing Instructional Services, Inc. It's a company offering remote viewing training to individuals and small groups. And he will be presenting his paper, which will then be commented on by Cindy Lefevre. And with no further ado, here is Paul.
Thank you. I apologize for the confusion up front and for the way the view gaps are going to be. It's going to be kind of tough, I think, for everybody to see them, but we'll do the best we can. In fact, Chris, if you could kind of twist a little bit so it's a little more parallel there, it would be good. See how the screen's kind of this way? No, you'll have to do the base. Things weren't completely set up when we got in here, so we had to make some adjustments, some jerry-rigging here. Okay, first off, I want to ask, how many here had heard of remote viewing before they read the program? That's pretty good. About half of you. I'm impressed. How many of you heard it on Art Bell? Okay. I want to explain that to those of you who haven't afterwards, maybe a topic of discussion. Okay. For years, rumors floated around Washington that the Pentagon was using psychics to collect intelligence. Beginning in the early 80s and continuing for more than a decade, investigative journalist Jack Anderson, next slide, Jack Anderson, Dale Van Atter ran a number of columns with bits and pieces of information that they'd gleaned from confidential sources about these Psi spies. Periodically, others would surface with news alleging that the military consulted fortune tellers or crystal ball gazers to answer questions or solve intelligence problems that couldn't be handled with more conventional means. There was even one report that the Navy had tried communicating with one of its submarines, that was actually the Nautilus, using telepathy. Then, in the fall of 1995, the Central Intelligence Agency officially confirmed much of the story. A secret unit managed first by the Army and later by the Defense Intelligence Agency, which I'll call DIA after this, and based at Fort Meade, Maryland, had for 17 years been doing operational, using these psychic skills operationally in a discipline known as remote viewing, or RV, to gather intelligence about threats to our national security. Remote viewing was a sort of disciplined clairvoyance, as I describe it, that allowed those trained in the skill to spy on targets closed to all other means of access. During its existence, the unit collected intelligence on a broad range of targets: strategic missile forces, political leaders, narcotics operations, research and development facilities, hostage situations, military weapons, secret military installations, technology developments. The list encompassed nearly every category of intelligence target. For 7 of the 17 years the unit existed, I was a member of it. I was trained to be a remote viewer and ultimately performed over 1,000 training and operational remote viewing sessions. But this is only where the story begins. Let me explain very briefly what remote viewing is. First of all, we have this humorous slider. Go ahead and put that up, Chris. This is what people kind of got the impression that we were talking about when they found out that the military was doing remote viewing. It actually wasn't like that. Remote viewing is a skill that allows a human remote viewer to consciously obtain information from a location, a person, event, anything like that, for which they have no other means of connection, that they have no conventional means of connection. They acquire this information mentally, or as seems to be the kind of the jargon, psychically. I refer to this as controlled clairvoyance because one of the most important features of the skill is self-control of mental noise. In what we call traditional ESP, one of the biggest problems has always been the competition one's own mind provides in the form of internally created impressions or suggestions or conflicting imagination kind of things that obscure and distort the valid psychic signals as they enter one's awareness or consciousness. Remote viewers refer to this noise as analytic overlay because it's the analytic part of your mind that's interfering here. Or we abbreviated AOL, and that we had that term before America Online came into existence. Although there might be some connection, I don't know what it is. There are two types of remote viewing done at Fort Meade, and I'm only going to talk about one of them. One was called ERV, and that was kind of a more traditional meditative hypnagogic kind of a thing. You laid down, you kind of got on the edge of sleep, and then you reported back what you were asked about. The other kind was called coordinate remote viewing, or now called controlled remote viewing, which is what I learned. And I'm going to just briefly discuss that. Put that off the side, please. And put that over. I'll be doing this myself, but then I couldn't get over I couldn't do the mic and the few guys at the time. I don't have what I was looking for. Okay. In the CRV, the coordinate remote viewing process, there's a number that's given, and in the old days it was a geographic coordinate, and today we use what we call an encrypted coordinate. I won't go into that because it's kind of complex. This number or coordinate cues the viewer's subconscious to react. First, it links the viewer mentally to the target about which you want information, and then it facilitates the process through which the actual information is obtained. At first, the data arrives in a form of very simple impressions which provide the overall concept of the target. Might be a mountain, a building, a person, an event, something like that. You just get this first flash of what this is. It's a building. It's a land area. Very general, very generic. Next, you get sensory data. Color, smell, sounds, textures. And then you start getting dimensional appreciation for this thing. You get the impression it's high, or it's wide, or it's rounded. As it progresses, and as you get deeper into the session, you start getting a little more substantive information, such as notions of governmental, or secret, or electronics, or aircraft-related, or weapon systems, or missile even. As you continue even further, you get even more detailed information from these responses until finally, if it's the kind of target that allows itself to have this done with, you can even make a three-dimensional model of it. Now, many of you have probably seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You see Richard Dreyfuss up there making Devil's Tower out of mashed potatoes. That's what you can actually do with this. You can actually create a model that in some sense, and sometimes very strikingly, resembles the actual target. And I have, let me show one here. This is an example of what you can see. If you've seen anybody been to Tulum, you probably recognize this, an archaeological site in Mexico, I believe. You see the actual target. Now, the remote viewer didn't have any of that information. All he got was a number. And in the process of going through the session, which took him about an hour or so, he produced that model on the bottom without having any idea what the target was. The interesting thing is you notice the little clay stairs that are added there. Those actually belonged up on the tower when the viewer built it. That's where he put it. But it fell off when the clay dried, and the photographer didn't know where it belonged, so he just propped it up there. It seemed to make sense to him. but of course, you know, if you can see from the actual photo there, it belongs up there where the viewer originally had it. Let me show you one more. That, why don't you sessions is one page at a time. Well, I'm going to show you actually a session that I did a long time ago. People like to see how this works. And you can see the process. With coordinate remote viewing, there's a lot of writing involved. In fact, it's all writing. You speak the words that you perceive, you know, to describe what you perceive, but you don't go beyond that. If you see everything that I spoke in this session is also written down, so you have a hard and fast record of it, and you can't go back and say, well, I said that, but you just didn't hear me, you know. If it's not on the paper, it doesn't count. So you see, I've got the coordinate up there, and you see a little squiggle. That's the first impression that you get of what it is. In this case, I couldn't identify it, but I went through and described that there's a number of words descriptive of what it is. I won't bother with going through detail on that, but go ahead and show the next page. You'll see little things off on the right side of the page. Those are AOL breaks, so analytic overlay. That's something I had the impression it was, but knew that that was a false impression. I perceived some element of the target that made sense to my analytic part of my mind, and it made this whole picture out of it that I knew was had something true about it was mostly wrong, and so I declared it as AOL. This is not right. The target resembles this, but this is not right. Okay, and you see I'm starting to get sketches a little bit. Okay, next one. Okay. This was a training session I did back when I was first learning how to do this. And you see, it's those of you who are into movie special effects will kind of see a resemblance to the morphing process you often see on the screen. It just kind of develops, it evolves into whatever the target turns out to be. And okay, next one, Chris. This was the final page, and you see I actually have a fairly recognizable sketch of what this is. I also had the impression that it had a mosque or a church feel, but I thought that was AOL because it seemed like my analytical mind had told me that. Go ahead and put the final one up. And this is what the target actually was. Yeah, Hagia Sophia. So I was quite pleased with that session, and my trainer was pleased with it as well. So that gives you an idea of kind of the process. Okay. The question is always asked, is remote viewing effective? Does it really work? And of course, the skeptics always say, no, it doesn't work, and for various reasons. But after some 25 years of experimental and operational remote viewing experience, the track record is sufficiently convincing for anyone willing to consider the evidence objectively. Unfortunately, most of the operational data that we collected during the course of our when the project was actually an intelligence collection project, most of that is still classified because some of it they're going to declassify, some of it they can't because it reveals other sources and methods that the government wants to maintain secure. But some of it will come out, and there's a lot of stuff on the outside that actually is good evidence for the actual success of this methodology. I'm not going to go into it. If someone's curious afterwards, I'll give you some ideas and some books to look at that will give you some of that evidence. There is one book, however, I want to mention. This is a book by recently published in 97 by science writer Jim Schnabel. It's called Remote Viewers. And there's a lot of interesting remote viewing results he mentions in there, and it unfolds a fairly accurate account of the government remote viewing program. It's not 100% accurate, but it's about as close as an outsider is ever going to get. Nonetheless, one must remember that remote viewing isn't always successful. There are a few commercial practitioners who currently claim that they are 100% successful. This is highly optimistic and may be doing a disservice to the field, which is, I'm sure you'll understand, already has credibility problems amongst the mainstream, by raising expectations to a level that real RV cannot fulfill. Now, there are a lot of skeptical responses to remote viewing, and I have a couple pages here, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over that. Perhaps later we'll have some time to discuss that. And now I want to get into how I see remote viewing fitting into the LDS worldview. Stories of governmental use of psychic phenomena can be quite titillating, as the immense media interest generated by the CIA's revelation shows. There's a far more deeper aspect that is usually missed by the hype and the hoopla. I believe one of the primary reasons skeptics continue so violently to reject evidence that humans indeed can function psychically is because of what that might mean for our current scientifically based intellectual paradigm. Steeped in the tradition of the great empiricist philosophers and totally immersed in the materialist ideologies of this century's logical positivist thinkers, my wife loves that phrase. She's always trying to get me to simplify and that has probably got more syllables in it than the whole rest of the page together. In any case, thanks to the logical positivist, there is no room for anything that cannot be explained within our current model of the physical universe. Religion has felt the sting of this, and so has parapsychology. Materialists reject the notion of psychic functioning for what to them are very good reasons. If a replicable psychic effect can be achieved and demonstrated at will, and if no physically based theory can account for that effect, then perhaps we do have reason to suspect that we indeed may be more than our physical bodies. That there may indeed be something beyond this world, beyond this material universe, even beyond this life. Contrary to what philosophy, abetted by science, has been teaching for a century and more. The floodgates might indeed open to what Carl Sagan disparagingly called the demon-haunted world of spirituality and religion. I believe that properly executed remote viewing is that replicable psychic effect that parapsychological researchers have hoped for and the skeptics have feared. This has profound implications for our culture and our view of the universe. I don't want to talk in detail here about RV's possible impact on science and all that. You could write books on that. I want to address how my experiences and the things I've come to understand have affected my understanding of the gospel as taught by the LDS Church. First, I want to give you a bit of a summary of my experiences here at Sunstone because they tie right in. Some of you may know that for 10 years, in fact, 10 years to this symposium, I've been associated with Sunstone in one way or another. I presented 5 or 6 papers and been a respondent, panelist, and a lot of others. It's a modest contribution. It's not hugely significant. But I was, during that time, consistently trying to sound a minor key in opposition to what I still perceive as an empiricist, materialist bias in the fabric of these Sunstone symposia. Very few people, but very few of you, just a few people who I revealed it to, had any idea that I had any involvement with this government program. But remote viewing has colored my presentations here from the start. My very first paper, presented here in 1988, was Mormonism and the 100th Monkey, LDS Doctrine in Light of Rupert Sheldrake's Hypothesis of Formative Causation. That always puts people asleep when I tell them that title. I'm not going to get into the content here, but I do want to say that Sheldrake actually proposes a model that I think potentially can reconcile science and religion. He's, of course, been rejected by the mainstream, but nonetheless, I think it's important. It finds, as I say here, finds great serendipity with the teachings of the restored gospel. A second paper I did was Mormonism and the New Age, in which I treated a number of topics relating to the metaphysical leanings of the New Age movement, and what connections and dissonances there might be with the LDS Church. Much of my own model reconciling Mormonism and parapsychology I incorporated in that presentation. My illusions of autocracy, why the LDS Church isn't as dictatorial as it looks, but what makes it sometimes seem that way, explored how, when we think we see failings and weaknesses in the organizational church, the weaknesses we encounter are often really those either in the very human personalities of our leaders, or our own, or sometimes both. The insights I brought out in that presentation I got from my time as recruiting and assessment officer for the RV unit. We used a number of personality assessment tools, including the Myers-Briggs and a number of others, and it gave me a whole new perspective of how personalities interact and how they relate in organizations. I had 3 other papers. One was War in Heaven, War on Earth. Another was Secret Yes, but Sacred Too, Ambivalent Attitudes Towards the Temple. And finally, Mormonism Seduced, the Materialist Worldview in the LDS Church. They were all heavily influenced by my realization that there is far more to reality than what our modern world allowed itself to believe exists within the confines of the physical world. And I talked about the seduction of Mormon intellectuals by that beckoning image. In 1988, I'd already been a remote viewer for 5 years, but I couldn't talk about it. Theoretically, I could have ended up in jail if I had. I didn't want to take the chance that it was more than theoretical. So, I'm in a sense coming full circle with this paper. I can talk fairly freely about experiences that had a profound effect on my life, and I think will eventually have a profound effect on the world in which we all live. So, let me go on and talk about what it all means to me. As we learn from LDS teachings, our lives did not start with mortal birth, contrary to what many other religions believe. We instead lived in a pre-existence, and we were as spirits. And as spirits, according to the discussions that I had as a missionary, we could speak without talking, could cross distances without walking, could presumably, through some intangible way, know things about other places that we could only have known had we physical bodies. Since we didn't, we couldn't do that theoretically. And all of this, of course, in spite of the fact that we had yet no physical bodies. By what we learn from the scriptures and the writings of prominent early church leaders, these notions about spirits seem to be accurate. And then we come to this existence. Okay, our spirits in some way are bonded or connected with our bodies. And we have this impression that our bodies and our spirits are coexistent in the same space, but I don't know if that's necessarily a given. They're connected in some way, and that's as far as I can go with that. I'm in danger of getting off on a tangent, so I better not pursue that. We pass through a veil which prevents us from knowing anything about our previous existence in the spirit world. However, though we may have lost the awareness of our celestial beginnings, nowhere does it say that we lost our previously held and practiced spiritual abilities. At most, it seems to me, we may have forgotten them along with everything else when we came through the veil. So I suspect that whenever a person develops some sort of psychic skill, he or she is just remembering, usually in rather imperfect form, spiritual abilities and skills he may have always possessed, but only fleetingly and vaguely recall while here in mortality. In this case, remote viewing may indeed be an attempt at spiritual seeing, in some sense, filtered through the heavy screen, Paul's a glass darkly, of our metaphysical mental processes, which leads to some interesting thoughts regarding spirits and bodies together, being the souls of humans. One of the things we are taught is that part of our mission here on Earth, as mortals, is to learn to allow our spirits to rule our bodies. Everybody's heard that, right? We usually take this to mean that we are to control our physical appetites by keeping them in line with God's commandments, and I think that's certainly part of it. But maybe that's just the first elementary step. Maybe we also are to learn eventually how to function spiritually while still in our bodies, as both God and Jesus Christ seem able to do. I doubt gaining this full functionality is within the ability of any of us here in mortality, but maybe some of us can make a start on it while we're here. There's also the issue as to what the source of the information that one receives while remote viewing is. Some more conservative Mormons are convinced that there are only two possible sources, God and Satan. Since this psychic stuff doesn't seem to be coming from any source authorized by God, it must therefore come from Satan. But I think there's something different going on here. We learn that in the Doctrine and Covenants that the power is in us to do much good without being directly moved upon by God or Satan. And just as we can conceive and perform evil acts all on our own without necessarily being influenced by Satan or God. I think I missed a page here. Okay, well, anyway. We Mormons believe also, contrary to any other Christian religion, that our ultimate existence is not dependent on God. We existed as intelligences before we were spirits, and these intelligences were co-evil with him. Excuse me, just think. Like, Chris, you can turn that off for now. Some fundamental essence of each of us has been around just as long as God has. He clearly has much more power and glory than we do, but ultimately we exist independent of him, and the very fact that we have this necessary existence means that we have some power of some kind, however minuscule, that is our own. And I strongly suspect that being subsequently created as spirits and acquiring physical bodies and going on from there has augmented that power in some way. So we are indeed agents unto ourselves, and we must decide how we will use our agency and what power there is that comes with it. Just as we can use our physical strength either to assault or to rescue someone, we may also use these spiritual powers either for good or evil, whatever our choice is. But there's also, obviously, a further question as to how the Holy Ghost fits into all this. For one thing, much that we attribute directly to the Holy Ghost, I suspect, is actually the Spirit working through our own resources to help us. I believe, for example, that we possess much unconscious power to heal our own bodies. The Holy Ghost is invoked through prayer and priesthood blessings, perhaps not always to heal us directly, but rather to unlock the power we ourselves have below the level of our awareness to help ourselves heal ourselves in some way. And I think a lot of the inspiration and outright revelation we get comes not as just a pouring in of new knowledge from the Holy Ghost, but the Holy Ghost helps us to piece together things we already knew or things that we have discovered in the process of our searching. Then all of a sudden it dawns on us, and the Holy Ghost is the catalyst, but the information was stuff we already had. And finally, I suspect the same pathways through which a remote viewer gains information may also be used by the Holy Ghost. I use an analogy of you had this set of railroad tracks, and the local commuter trains use these tracks, and the cross-country Amtrak expresses, all those shiny trains, you know, use those same tracks. Well, we might, by analogy, say that remote viewing are the commuter trains that just, you know, they kind of haphazard come back and forth, you know, and just do these short little jaunts and kind of mundane. And then the Holy Ghost is like the Pacific Zephyr or whatever they call these things, you know. They come from A to New York or whatever, you know, and they use the same set of tracks, but their nature and their quality is completely different. Excuse me. I want to talk about inspiration and revelation briefly. I don't claim to be the recipient of more inspiration or revelation than any other member of the church, but I think I perhaps understand the process a bit better now for the experience I've had. I no longer doubt that inspiration and revelation can and do occur, for example, and that the information and insight they convey originates from outside our individual selves. In an era in which the secular world explains such things away as mere rumblings from one's subconscious or as the brain's right hemisphere whispering to the left, this insight is of no small consequence and importance. Second, I recognize the subtlety of the spiritual signal. There is a qualitative between it and our normal mental processes, but it's sometimes very hard to recognize because it's so rarefied and nuanced, particularly if one is not practiced in the art of recognizing it. It is easily lost amongst our many other thoughts and imaginings. Still, small voice seems kind of poetic in the way it's phrased, but it actually is very descriptive of the experience when the Spirit speaks to us. We learn in the church that we need to listen for that still small voice and continually work at increasing our receptivity to it. And there is really no other way to learn to recognize it. This leads to my third point, the problem of signal-to-noise ratio. Remember I talked about AOL, analytic overlay, all that mental noise. This is a term that remote viewing theory borrows from radio propagation, the signal-to-noise ratio, and it is a very excellent analogy between the two and relates to the principle of revelation as well. Things like, you know, the analytic part of your mind or physical, what we call physical inclemencies, like being sick or whatever, or having emotional problems, whatever, and in fact even telepathic overlay. All of these things exist. In fact, the whole structured process of remote viewing that I learned, its primary goal was to help you overcome all this stuff going on inside your head that distorts or masks the true signal that you're trying to receive. Without that, no remote viewer wouldn't function any better than the typical 20% that what we call a natural psychic does. But we all run into these same problems when you're dealing with trying to perceive the Holy Ghost or trying to recognize the whisperings of the Spirit. You have all of that overlay. Is it your own desires, your own wishes, your own problems and things that you're paying attention to, or is it the Spirit of the Lord whispering to you? We all have to learn how to sort that out. And I've learned that how important that is through remote viewing, and I've also learned that it is possible to do, too. Which you have to be extremely honest with yourself in determining what the source of the particular apparent information that you're getting is. Okay, next I want to talk about prophecy, free will, and the foreknowledge of God. And for this I have to talk about another experience I had. It was the 15th of May, 1987. It was a typical day at the remote viewing unit. I was tasked to do a remote viewing session by a guy named Ed. And I didn't know it, but the task that day was, the number that I was given stood for basically the phrase, they wanted me to answer the question, what is the most important thing for us to know today? Or for the next few days. So I went over, they gave me the number, I did the session, and this is what I described. In the course of the session, I perceived a warship steaming peacefully at night in the constricted body of water. There was, on three sides, immense stretches of flat, sandy terrain, and most of the people on the ship were asleep. Not yet. Thanks, though. I was about to forget to tell you to do that. I next perceived an airplane. It seemed to be coming from the north, heading away from this sandy terrain. And at a certain point, the aircraft dropped something that was long, thin, and tubular, and had these little stubby wings. And it emitted a kind of a guttural, buzzing, roaring kind of a sound. And it seemed to fly around erratically like this. At a certain point, the airplane hit the ship, this thing that was flying around hit the ship, and all of a sudden I get the impression of fire and smoke and fire hoses and people in consternation and hollering and shouting and all kinds of chaos going on. And then I was asked to kind of backtrack and see where this aircraft had come from. And it seemed to be directed by a bunch of people located in a third world country that was far inland in a broad sandy area. The city was largely flat-roofed, masonry structures. I had animals in the streets. It was clearly third world. And the people directing the aircraft were military, rather unprofessional, but military. And they wore tan uniforms, and black and green were important colors to them. The whole episode with the aircraft seemed to have been a game of chicken. That was my perception from it. I got a lot more details I'm not going to go into right here, but the guy who was running the session, the monitor, Ed, said he finally told me to quit. He said, I'm sorry, Paul, you're just off today. You know, not everybody can, you can't be on all the time, so, you know, you got to take some losses with the winds. So I said, okay, and we went home for the weekend. Then, on Monday morning, they called me up and said, hey, where's that session you did on Friday? And I said, it's my safe. And they said, get in here quick and dig it out. I said, why? And they said, look at the newspaper. Go ahead, Chris. Yeah, that's what it was. The headlines of that morning's Washington Post read, Iraqi missile sets U.S. frigate ablaze, causing casualties. The USS Stark in the Persian Gulf had been struck by an Exocet anti-ship missile fired by an Iraqi fighter bomber. And as the details of this incident emerged, it became clear that I had described this thing perfectly, that I hadn't even got anything wrong, which is, of course, an extreme rarity in any session. But in this case, it was quite remarkable. In fact, a few years after that, I got a copy of the after-action report and found out some things I'd reported in there they didn't have any answers to at the time turned out also to be accurate. So it was quite amazing. Okay, this session on the Stark has a number of implications for LDS doctrine. The operational implications I'll talk about some other time, some other venue. The first is that, you can turn that off, Chris. The first is that, despite current scholarly beliefs to the contrary, prophecy is a reality. If it is true that I, an otherwise ordinary person, just doing my job in a government psychic espionage unit, which some people would say is a little unordinary, but if I could do that, if I could describe the future so specifically, how could anyone deny that a prophet, Isaiah, Abraham, Joseph Smith, any of them, might not be able to do the same and more when directly influenced by God? As only one example, the implications for this. For quite a while now, one of the arguments against their in favor of there being more than one Isaiah is that there's no way that someone writing 2.5 centuries before the fact could possibly know what's going to happen that far in the future, even by just guesstimating. It's not possible. Well, there's other issues with the Isaiah thing, but that, I think, is a red herring, because as this session demonstrated, although this was only 2 days in advance of the event, if God is working with it, it's certainly possible that 2.5 centuries in the future someone could predict something accurately. I stop and paraphrase some of this thing in front of the place again. There are other interesting implications as well, particularly involving free will and God's foreknowledge. Unlike the past, which has already happened and is fixed in time and space, and which, by the way, we can remote view the past equally accurately as with the present. It seems to be equally accessible. The future is not, however, fixed. It hasn't, after all, happened yet. And in fact, even that final course, what final course the future may take, has not yet been resolved. Every event in the world, every happenstance, every decision affects the direction the future may take. I call these points for the future branches, I call them decision notes. Now, if I had a board up here to write on, I could sketch this out a little bit better. But if you think of the past and the present as the trunk of a tree, when you get to the branches, they start branching out. That's the future. And the real timeline can take any one of a number of those branches, depending on if you come to three forks, the future might take any one of those three, depending on what random variables affected or whatever non-random choices are made. And so consequently, when you get far enough out, there are all these possible alternate futures that any one of which could actually be realized if you were to trace it from the present. But the farther out you get, you know, the more of these futures proliferate. This is not making much sense without the board drawn, but at any rate, so let's, for example, the example I was using. I could walk out that door over there, I could walk out that door over there. Walk out that door over there, a safe falls on me, kills me. That cuts that timeline right off. Okay, I presume there's no safes out there. But anyway, I walk out this door, I don't get hit by the safe, I live to be 93 or 120 or whatever. You can see that just a small happenstance like that can affect the world to a great extent one way or another, not just for me, but for all the people I might interact with in the future. So I think you can see how this unfolds. Now, the interesting thing is that a remote viewer can oftentimes view a future event and be absolutely convinced that that event is accurate, that they've accurately remote viewed it. And then when the time for that to be realized comes and it doesn't happen, then he's got egg on his face. And everybody says, oh, you blew it. You're no good. You know, you can't do that. He says, I don't understand. It seemed like the right, you know, it seemed right at the time. And it probably was, because when you get far enough down the time stream, any one of those alternate futures is possible. You have equal weight. And so if you go out and try and, you know, perceive the future too far out, your subconscious says, well, this looks like a good one. It just picks one, you know, and says, okay, let's report on this one. But by the time the future gets there, it may have been shifted off of that timeline by any number of random choices, and therefore all of those other possible futures are not actualized. And so it turns out that the viewer seems to be wrong. Now, that's a very rough description of this. There's a lot of implications that I can't get into here. But what it all amounts to, and I've already paraphrased things so much I can't figure out why I'm at, this can explain how God knows everything, and yet we still have our free choice. Let us say that God knows what all of those alternate future possibilities are. He knows every possible thing that could happen based on every possible one of these decision nodes. If it trips this way, he knows what will happen. If it trips this way, he knows what will happen. He knows all of that. And so he would, in a sense, have omniscience. He knows everything. But there's one critical thing he doesn't know, and that is he doesn't know which of those choices we're going to make at any given time. He can predict, probably with great accuracy, for the most part, that there will be always a little bit of uncertainty there as to how our futures turn out. For the most part, he can probably say, well, you're going to end up like this, you're going to end up like this. And in the end, he probably knows how it all comes together again, because he'll know how all of those possible futures collapse. But he may not be able to tell in the intermediate time how we're going to choose. And so we still have a certain amount of free choice in that regard. Okay. Let me now return to a more concrete subject, materialism. As mentioned before, I believe there is an unfortunate tendency in many Sunstone presentations, as well as elsewhere in the church, to fall prey to the rampant mechanistic reductionist paradigm. There's more syllables for you. Mechanistic reductionist paradigm that is the bedrock of modern academia and science. The problem is not too peculiar only to Sunstone. As I pointed out in one of my earlier papers, it's a problem with people, many people in the church. We are steeped in materialist values and attitudes, and it's impossible to escape the infection altogether. We are often in danger of trusting more in science or the government or medicine or whatever than we do in God. One of my philosophy professors recently is trying to explain why he was convinced that eventually we'll be able to prove that the mind is the brain, that there is nothing non-physical about our personalities, about our mental existence. And he said that the reason that he is confident that will happen is because science has been able to explain so much. Many times in the past when we've had this, you know, some kind of spiritual or religious explanation for something, science has come along and proven that it is really, there are really physical laws governing it, and that you can dispense with the religious aspect, and it works just as well. What my professor and many more like him are in deep denial of is that science only explains those things it can explain. Like Procrustes, it cuts off and throws away anything that doesn't fit, often declaring it non-existent. Later during that same class, My professor was asked by another student why science hadn't yet managed to fully explain away and put to rest such phenomena as UFOs and parapsychology. His answer was that such things were just too hard for science to do. It couldn't get a grip on them because, assuming they had any reality at all, they probably would not be able to be explained in terms that would make sense to science. And therefore, it made no sense for scientists to even bother investigating them. That reminded me of the joke about the guy who's on his hands and knees, you know, under the light post looking for his contact lens, and the guy strolls by and says, "Why, what are you doing there?" He says, "I lost my contact lens." He said, "Well, where did you lose it?" He said, "Well, over there," and he points over in the dark. And he says, "Well, why don't you look for it where you lost it?" He says, "Because the light's over here." To a great degree, we inherited this attitude from the logical positivists of the 1920s through the 50s. That logical positivism kind of succumbed to its own, under its own weight, it kind of fell under its own weight. But a lot of what they believed about physical world versus the non-physical world, we have inherited. They did not believe that there was anything non-physical and that everything would be proved scientifically eventually. Now, I don't mistake me, I value the keen-edged tools that scientific method and rational thought represent. They continue to be indispensable in advancing our understanding of the world. They're also useful in combating ignorance, prejudice, and stupidity, occasionally even where the church is concerned. The problem arises when we begin to accept the scientific approach almost as a substitute for religion and lose sight of the fact that science's instruments and methods are, when you get right down to it, just more tools crafted by mere human hands. This is where my experience with remote viewing enters this part of the discussion. And I'm speaking just like an outsider here. The fact that a replicable psychic effect exists that can't be explained in materialist terms allows us to again reasonably consider the proposition that there's more to the universe than just physical existence. We can no longer necessarily rule out the possibility of prophecy, and we can no longer reject the possibility of inspiration or revelation, nor can we necessarily assume that God is merely a myth. Because we know that there are things that can't be thus explained by science. No longer can we consider it outside the realm of possibility that some higher being can indeed communicate with representatives here on Earth. Remote viewing doesn't prove God's existence. I'm not making that claim. Nor does it prove the certainty of an afterlife. It only proves that such things really are possible, an option that materialist science has been doing its best to reject for way too long. While we still need faith and prayer to solicit spiritual guidance, at least faith can be considered a reasonable thing to have now, outside of, you know, religious circles. I want to remind you that most of what I talked about today is purely my own speculations based on my own experiences, and I don't intend to present it in any way that it would constitute official doctrine or anything like that, either of church or of science. But it makes sense to me, and I feel like I've had some confirmation of its truth. I'm always worried that somebody will latch on to remote viewing as some sort of end in itself, something to get religious about, or even something to be turned into a religion, in the process ignoring the commandments and great truths of the gospel. I try to discourage anybody from making RV out to be more than it is. But it is still something, even if, apart from its uses in intelligence and a few other specialized applications, it presently has not gone much beyond being a part of the game. It's not the practical uses of remote viewing that I think are important, so much as its implications. Remote viewing, I think, this is my opinion, will yet prove to have a vital impact on how we in our present culture think about ourselves and about the universe. And I think from a gospel perspective, that will be good. Thank you.
Okay, skip introduction stuff. I want to state up front that I am a believer. Okay, Paul's paper adequately addresses the responses of skeptics. I'm not one of them. I have trust in Paul's personal and professional integrity, and if he says that he has done this and it works, then as far as I'm concerned, he has done this and it works. My job here is not to dispute the truthfulness of what he has said about his experiences, but to offer my opinion on the premise of this particular paper, and I promise to be very brief because I'm sure you don't want to hear me. You want to have a ton of questions you want to ask Paul. Paul has written a very careful paper. He was very careful about the title of the paper, so that the title is both precisely accurate and a bit misleading in two ways. First is the careful choice of the word gospel. Now, many mainstream members don't make the distinction between the gospel and the church, and they generally think that one or two are the same, but it is an important distinction that most Sunstoners recognize, so I'm not going to belabor that point. Paul's title specifies what my 7 years as a government remote viewer taught me about the gospel. He wisely does not reference the modern church. The second way that the title is accurate but a bit misleading is that it implies but does not expressly or explicitly promise a reconciliation, a resolution of the dissonance that Paul has, understandably, between what he knows to be true from actual experience, rather unique and compelling experience, and what the church has taught him to be true with a capital T. Clearly, such experiences would create both enormous dissonance and enormous opportunity for either refuting or confirming long-held dear beliefs about what the church teaches about the other side. I came to the paper hoping to hear about this implied reconciliation, and I was disappointed. First, I'd like to comment on what Paul did say. He makes 5 specific claims based on his experiences. 1, there's more to life than material physical existence. 2, he believes that the spiritual goal of spirits ruling our bodies or mind over body may include the power to learning to use the power that we already acquired in the spirit while we're still in the body. And he suggests that this concept may validate the doctrine of preexistence. He specifically mentions healing and recognizing inspiration of 2 examples of learning how to use power, spiritual power, already acquired in the spirit. Well, as we know, inspiration and healing are the 2 spiritual gifts that the church will allow its members to acquire. Paul suggests, 3, that the still small voice of inspiration may be a form of psychic impressions, and that these impressions may be born discernible with proper training. Training in remote viewing teaches the individual how to weed out his or her own wants, desires, and imaginations. He believes the methods used by remote viewers to obtain information may involve the same mechanism used by the Holy Spirit to convey inspiration. 4, Paul can relate a rather compelling experience where he actually made a prediction about the future based on psychically acquired information, and therefore revelation is possible. And finally, 5, his remote viewing experiences have provided a framework for understanding the paradox between God's omniscience and human free agency. I think it's important to remember that all of these beliefs about the spiritual realms are also held by many other religions and groups. Actually, all of these items are a matter of semantics, and if spoken of carefully using the right terminology, could be very acceptable to a mainstream Mormon audience. And again, Paul does this. He's very careful and uses the right terminology. I'm going to skip this bit about the tone and discrediting about the psychic spies. He's got a bit of a defensive posture here. That's understandable. I saw the A&E video that they did a special on psychic spies and featured Paul as well as his colleagues. Helped me understand a little bit better why he feels he has to credit it, because it's been an uphill battle from the scientists all along. However, he does assume a Mormon audience in his paper that has been, as he says, seduced by the materialist worldview. I don't think that most Mormons, Sunstone or mainstream, have been seduced by a materialist worldview. My experience with both mainstream members and Sunstoners is that we hold on to our beliefs and hopes about the spiritual realms very tenaciously indeed, sometimes more than the leadership, which is part of a bigger problem and a response to another paper. But from the discussion provided in this paper, I think it's clear that Paul's experiences as an intelligence-gathering remote viewer have provided him with hope that some of the church's doctrines about the spiritual realms might be true. He seems unable to make these experiences fit into the Mormon worldview, or rather spirit view, so he tries to open or expand the Mormon box in order to accommodate his experiences via semantics, and I think he largely succeeds in this effort via his careful and guarded approach. Now, at the risk of being called to polemic, I'd like to briefly comment on what the paper does not discuss. The paper fails to address the largest and most important doctrine of the Church, the possession of exclusive truth. This is Mormonism's claim to fame, and it cannot successfully be ignored or dismissed. In order to resolve the dissonance created by his experience as a psychic spy, Paul must establish that teachings unique to the Church are true. All the paper does is acknowledge some elements of spiritual existence shared by other religions, and he does a bit talk about the unique doctrine of spiritual existence independent of God, but a careful reading of the paper reveals that he doesn't offer any remote viewing insights or experiences to validate his brief comments about it. Ultimately, Paul's silence on the important point of exclusive truth is so loud that it is deafening. Although the title carefully references the gospel and not the church, Paul does not clarify this point in the paper. The paper fails to reconcile gospel doctrine with the contemporary message of the organized church, with its focus on obedience as taught by the general leadership today. I suspect that Paul is very aware of this. Paul's paper harkens back to a time in the church when, as I clearly remember, members were told by the leadership to seek truth themselves, to find out for themselves, to get their own inspiration and guidance from the Spirit. Now members are told to follow the brethren. They are told when the prophet speaks, the thinking has been done. Paul's experiences are essentially the antithesis of these teachings of the contemporary church. Paul's experiences seem to have convinced him that non-physical information is accessible to virtually everyone. He encourages people to learn it. In fact, he has begun a personal business training folks in the how-to methods of remote viewing. This is well and good, and I have thorough faith that he can do this, and that training very definitely helps. It does not, however, support the precept that one cannot be trained for the ministry, so to speak. More importantly, teaching this skill invalidates the notion of priesthood power and the keys of revelation. Priesthood power and the keys of revelation are primary elements of Mormon doctrine. Mormonism claims to have a living prophet who has the ability, the responsibility, the job, to receive revelation from God for everyone on earth, and to whom, therefore, everyone must be obedient in order to be righteous and worthy in the eyes of God. And this is what the one bit of Mormon doctrine that appears to be unchangeable. Paul's prophetic experiences as an ordinary guy, and I'm so glad you all laughed at that because I nearly fell on the floor when I read it. This ordinary guy who just happens to be a U.S. military psychic spy implicitly disavows the church's insistent focus on priesthood authority and priesthood power. Now, a lot of folks will try to push this envelope, and I've heard some mainstreamers try to do it, by asking rather ridiculously, did Paul's status as a Melchizedek priesthood holder give him a special ability to do this remote viewing? Now, from all accounts, his colleagues in the remote viewing program, who are not members of the church and who do not hold the priesthood and keys of revelation, were able to remote view with as much success as Paul. Now, were those men just coincidentally prospective elders with spiritual gifts or ones that need to have the priesthood? And I think not.
They're about 50% female, by the way.
I'm getting there because I said, I offer proof that this is not the case because I found out, and I confirmed this with Paul before we got here, that in training for this and in doing this, he has also trained, hold on to your hats, folks, women. Plainly negating the principle of priesthood keys being necessary to receive revelation. So the paper works and it doesn't work. Paul has succeeded in convincing me that remote viewing has value and that he has been successful doing it. He has prophesied. He has seen. He has revealed for more than 7 years. Now, I'm not going to start standing up every time he walks into the room.
I am.
I'm not going to do that, but I'm reasonably confident that he has the ability to do this. He has provided no evidence that would indicate that anyone in the upper level management of this church has the same ability. I'm convinced that the materialist paradigm is false. However, I remain unconvinced that Paul has discovered anything significant about the church's usefulness or the gospel's truthfulness in his remote viewing experiences, but again, he did not promise any such thing. I'd love to have the money to go and do this training with him. I think it's possible to learn how to weed out my own imaginations and fantasies and hopes and desires so that I could hear that still small voice. I believe that this is the most important point and useful part of remote viewing, but that's probably because I'm not involved in military espionage. I also believe that the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. So I'm gratified to know that good men like Paul have been involved in maintaining the security and freedom of this country. And I'm very saddened to think that despite their proven record, credibility was such an uphill battle for him and his colleagues when the program was in operation. So I hope that Paul's current business teaching remote viewing will have a major impact on the worldview of Western society. I also hope that the rest of his military files will be declassified soon to enable him to speak more openly about more of his experiences. Given the current corporate church and military mentality, Paul's careful and guarded approach in this paper is understandable. But I look forward to hearing another paper in the future with much more to say on this subject. Thank you.
Just had a real quick announcement. Now, I know there's tons of questions. First off, if you want to hear more about the specifics of remote viewing, I'm giving a lecture over at the Golden Braid Bookstore on Wednesday, the 5th of August at 7 o'clock. It's somewhere 5th South or something like that. Golden Braid Bookstore, no entrance fee or anything. You just come and listen if you want.
What's the date?
Oh, in Austin, Texas. I'm going to turn that on, Chris. I also have to apologize. Cindy reminded me. I was going to tell you up front, all I had along was the slides I use when I give a commercial lecture. So I seem to be advertising my business. That's not my intent. But here's my contact information. If you got a question or if you want to get to my webpage, I got a lot of information on remote viewing there. It's my commercial webpage, but there's stuff that's non-commercial on there as well. So you're free to, you know, to contact me in the future about that.
The 100th Monkey paper is up on that website.
Yeah, the 100th Monkey is on that, as is this paper in its completeness. I skipped over a lot of stuff in this paper. Okay, questions? Yes? Okay.
From your perspective, why would Gerald and Sandra Tanner have been correct in saying the Salamander letter by Mark Hoffman was a forgery, in view of the fact that the prophet of the Mormon Church and First Presidency said they had no reason to believe it wasn't genuine, and even had pictures in the Ensign magazine of them looking at it?
Okay. I don't know. That I could probably talk for 15 or 20 minutes on that and still not come to a conclusion. I prefer not to answer that right now, but if you want to talk about it afterwards, I'd be happy to. Geez, I don't know who's first. I'll go to the back room there. Yes.
I'm confused about what you mean by the church. Cindy seems to mean the contemporary church and not the same thing. I see things in the doctrine that suggests that even women can become, can speak prophecy.
Right.
And so forth.
So I don't see
a conflict. Cindy's my best friend, and I don't agree with her.
And
I don't see a conflict in what you're saying. You're saying
that
people that are not members of the church have it,
right,
by virtue of being
created. Right. And I agree that. I don't think church says that revelation is strictly only practiced by the prophet. In fact, it tells us that in our own stewardships, our own families, and our own lives, we're entitled to personal inspiration and revelation. And that's how I understand it. And so, you know, we might not agree either. Cindy and I have disagreed on things in the past, so that's okay. But anyway, I agree with that. Okay, another question. Yes?
Did you have any abilities that were kind of guided you into this, or did you learn these, or what?
Well, they taught me how to do it, and so that's what I'm doing now, is teaching other people how to do it. But I didn't have any psychic experiences before they recruited me. I just happened to be the right kind of personality with the right kind of interest. They said, you're open-minded enough, we'll draft you. And I learned, in fact, I was a skeptic. I doubted ESP existed at the time I was recruited, and then all of a sudden it worked, and I was totally amazed. Okay, I guess I'll go with you next, and then we'll get over here.
I'm really curious. What's the significance of the number that we gave you, and why would that key in something to start
with? Yeah, that's another 15-20 minute dialogue, but I'll try to answer it real quick. The number they give you, you consciously don't know what that means. Your subconscious is somehow tapped into a greater reservoir. I think the subconscious and the spirit are the same, and the spirit communicates with all the other spirits and everything else on some other dimensional level. We're getting pretty heavy speculation here, but at any rate, somehow when you get below the conscious threshold, you tap into something that's more general, maybe the cosmic unconscious, whatever that is. You know, it's a popular... Yeah, it's a popular New Age term, but yeah, and that's another explanation. A morphogenetic field, like Sheldrake. Yeah. At any rate, the number itself doesn't mean anything to us consciously, but subconsciously, somehow, the subconscious, and this is maybe a telepathic element in remote viewing, the subconscious picks up on the intent of the person that's tasking you, perhaps, and the number is just the go signal. There's several different ways of laying this out. Okay, I promise you. Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned personality type several times. I'm curious, what personality types do you find most successful?
I find people who are extremely introverted have a harder time with this. They aren't totally unsuccessful, and some introverts are extremely successful, but generally speaking, they tend to be. I get a lot of, I don't know why this is, I get a lot of electrical engineers, highly introverted electrical engineers wanting to take my course. And they get there, and they spend most of their time doubting the information they're getting. And so you go along, you know, and they'll start saying this stuff, and they'll say, oh, no, that isn't right. And they'll say, what was it? No, it can't be right. And they'll say, well, tell me what it was. And they'll say, well, I get this idea of, what's an example? A big, tall structure with crisscross beams and all that stuff, and the target will be the Eiffel Tower, and they won't believe it, you know? So anyway, okay, I know I didn't answer it completely, but I got to go on. Yes?
I have two questions. One is, if you guys are successful, why did CIA cancel it? And number two is, the people who originated this remote viewing procedure, who are they?
Okay, put that up, Chris. I have pictures of both of those. Put the angle up first. This one and then the next one. This is the guy who's the father of remote viewing. His name is Ingo Swann. He's a New York artist and become a parapsychologist. He actually got his degree here in Salt Lake at Westminster College. But he got out there, and then he linked in with, go ahead, put the next one up. He linked up with a guy named Hal Puthoff. He's a PhD physicist from Stanford. He wrote a classic in laser physics, which is still being used. He's the guy over here. This photo is from the 70s, as you can tell by their attire and their hairstyles. The guy in the middle was one of their better remote viewers who died of a heart attack in Las Vegas about 10 years ago or a little more. The guy on the farthest over there is he was a CIA operative who is now vice president in a major automaker. I won't tell you his name because he's a little leery of that. But anyway, those are the guys that put this thing together originally, and it is really based on a lot of scientific principles and a lot of speculation on scientific principles. But I could go on longer about that too, but I'm going to have to move on. Let's move over to this side. Oh, I'm sorry, what was your other one? Oh, why did it get canceled? That's a long explanation too, but largely it was the CIA had been embarrassed too many times by too many politically sensitive operations they'd been involved in. Congress dumped it in their laps. They've been the ones that started originally in the early 70s. They bailed out because they all of a sudden they ran into trouble with this LSD experiments on unwitting people, you know, and all that stuff. And they were told to get rid of everything that was in any way embarrassing, so they jettisoned the psychic program as well. Then in 1994, Congress told them they were going to take it over again from DIA because Congress didn't like what DIA was doing with it. CIA didn't want it, so they came up with this report that allegedly proved it unuseful so they could justify to Congress not pursuing it. It was the political thing. It had nothing to do with how successful it really was, even though it looks like that on the surface. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. 1 minute left. We actually have less than that left, but yes.
What do you see the correlation or similarities between your RV processor training to the old-fashioned prayer meditation and fasting?
Well, I think both of them are ways of tuning in to whichever signal line, if you want the spiritual signal line, or you just want to get information for national defense, whatever. They're both ways of trying to drive a wedge through all this mental noise that we have? That's a very quick answer. That's worthy of a paper in its own right. So we'll have to leave it at that. Go ahead.
You mentioned Myers-Briggs personality types, and apparently there's a correlation between those personality types and the type of people who are able to do this, like intuitive feeling people. The type you were describing, they call it ISTJ.
Those are kind of don't do well.
Right.
Don't do well. A lot of you don't speak Myers-Briggs, so I'll just make this real quick. But I was an ENTP. They found that ENTJs, INTPs, INTJs did pretty well. But beyond that, there's lots of room for exploration here. It may not correlate according to those personality types. We just haven't done enough research in that regard.
You're an ENTP.
I'm an ENTP. Yeah. Okay. Listen, I'm going to go over here to the step down lounge. If you have more questions, come on over and we'll try and answer them all. I'm sorry not to let you get another chance.
Okay.
Thank you.